Morning, everyone. Thank you for attending today. This is the Board of Regents' first quarterly meeting. Call to order. I'll ask Secretary Harris to call the roll.
Regent Bale.
Present.
Regent Birch.
Present.
Barry Higdon.
Here.
Regent Henson.
Present.
Regent Johnson.
Here.
Regent McKinney.
Present.
Regent Porter.
Here.
Regent Ritchie.
Here.
Regent Ridley.
Here.
Regent Smith.
Here.
Mr. Chair, we have 11 full board.
Secretary Harris, declare we have quorum to conduct business. Now move to the approval minutes. Start with the fourth quarter meeting on October 28, 2016. We have a motion.
So move.
Regent Johnson moved.
Second.
Regent Smith second. Any further discussion? All in favor, aye?
Aye.
Opposed, no. Fourth quarterly meeting minutes are approved. Next, moving to special call meeting on January 8, 9, 2017. Any additions or corrections? Motion?
So move.
Regent Johnson moved.
Second.
Regent Henson second. Any other discussion? All in favor, aye?
Aye.
Opposed, no. Special call minutes of January 8, 9, 2017 are approved. Next, we'll move to the academic affairs portion of the agenda. Chair Bale, please take over.
We have several action items on our agenda. These were all discussed at our December committee meetings. And
no, Dr. Bale, as you say, these were all pretty thoroughly discussed in December. I think the new programs are all pertinent to some very significant things, addressing teacher quality issues. We're recognizing some faculty who are very distinguished retirees from this institution with emeritus status, and we're also approving a sabbatical leave for faculty members at some significant points in their career. So I think this has all been very thoroughly discussed. I'm happy to respond to any questions, but I think it's a very good package of proposals.
Anyone have any questions for I'll ask that items A1, A2, A3, A4, A5 all be considered and consent. Motion.
So moved.
Second.
Approval by Dr. Ritchie and second by Dr. Birch. Further discussion. If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, like sign. Motion passes. That's all we have on our docket.
Thank you, sir. Next, we'll move to the executive committee. First item was approved and recommended out of the executive committee for full board consideration. Any other discussions? Comments on the approval of naming designated rooms. State a motion for approval.
So move.
Second.
McKinney, move. I had a second from this. Later, Porter, second. A motion and a second. All in favor, aye. So approved.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to note that I did not vote on that. I abstained from that due to a conflict.
Regent Ridley, so noted in the minutes. The next matter for the executive committee is an information item for Brian Russell.
Well, Brian Russell's coming forward. As the board knows, I did a survey of board members 6 or 8 weeks ago of topics you would like to see addressed over the next two meetings, this meeting and the April meeting. And there are three or four items that had the most preferences indicated among you, and capital project priorities was one of those. So we'll start with this meeting, and there are two or three items that specifically on the April agenda that you indicated interest in hearing reports and having discussions about. We'll cover as many of those as we practically can over the next meeting, and we'll start with your interest in understanding what our capital project priorities are going forward.
Good morning.
Morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
Well, this is our a snapshot of the Ogden College Hall Science Project. Wanted to share with everybody its progress. We've had great weather, so we're going to do an overview of just a few things. This project is sitting over on 14th Chestnut and State Street, and you can see by the photographs that's moving along very well. We started in February of 2016. We've updated the square footage to actual, still four-story, 36 labs, physics, biology, chemistry. Has a 300-seat auditorium to the State Street side of the building. Show some details of the stonework, windows being put in. On the ground floor, through the stories, we've already started to install drywall, which is really good for this early in the project. We have a completion date of the whole project. It's going to be substantially December 2017. So you see all the mechanical work that's up in the ceilings. And I think this gives a real view for the board to see how that project is fits into the surrounding buildings and on that site, and it's going to be a great addition to WKU students. Anybody have any questions on that particular project? Our second project that I wanted to give everybody a peek at is our student-led parking garage. It's over on Creason parking lot. We see the foundations, piers, the ground floor area of that building has been completed. What's really good about this is that first week two of February, they're actually going to start bringing in the precast pieces that are coming out of Owensboro, Kentucky. And they'll actually start, probably second week of February, start putting floor one, two, three, four, up to seven. Just to remind the board, we have added an additional floor to the building. The project was bid, and it was very successfully bid. And so we are going to have a maybe. The project goal was 500 spaces net, but we're actually going to get 608 spaces by adding that additional floor. So for the same $10 million, J. Todd, we actually were very successful. It's going to be a beacon, top of the building. You see the WKU, that's going to be a lighted WKU. It actually is going to be WKU on four sides. So as anybody comes in from any direction, you'll be able to see that, and people that come into our community through Morgantown Road, Russville Road, those areas will be able to say, go to the WKU sign. The one on the medical center, I think when you drive by on the bypass at night, it really is a good look. And that's what that was modeled after. So that'll be completed in September of this year, right after school starts, and it'll be a nice addition to campus. Wanted to show this site. This is I've always called it the Valley of the Dolls, but it is actually between Rhodes, McCormick, and Gilbert Hall. They're residence halls. In January, Student Life Foundation started the work there and did an early site package. We've got it secured. We work with the contractor to make sure that we keep construction debris, dirt off of the College Heights Boulevard. This is the rendering of the 400 and I think Brian updated that, about 408 beds?
410.
410 beds. Facility. And we anticipate that to be completed fall of 2018, but it's going to be very attractive on that corridor of Western's campus. I don't know if anybody's seen this or not, but this is our foundation building on the hill. It's been tucked in there for a long time over the years, and kind of the backside of the president's office. And but we have a project that we have been doing a study on, and I wanted to show you what the transformation of that building is going to be. So there is, in the future, using private funds, a strategy to do an update of that particular building on our campus. So I hope everybody likes that. This picture here is just kind of an aerial view of our campus, but what we wanted to demonstrate or show here is that tucked in on the hillside is Garrett Conference Center. I have to get this. Is this building right here? That building was built originally in 1951. It's very close to about 83,000 gross square feet. Actually, when the building was built, it was only built with a ground and a first floor. In the 60s, they actually added another floor to the building, which we call the ballroom. But the upcoming project or RFP that we have out for food service, there will be funds made available to do a full renovation of that building, and it really needs it. It really has had no work, substantial work done to the mechanical, electrical pieces of that building since 51. This is a viewpoint of that, and it'll transform and match the architecture of the surrounding buildings on our campus. We've just done a study. We have not actually done any engineering work or details, so that will follow. And this is just a architectural rendering of what it could be. So we've got a lot of work to do. John?
I noticed there's a cupola on top of that building. Is that now starting to compete, the numerous cupolas that we have, with Cherry Hall? Because that'll be almost exactly on the same vertical and horizontal that Cherry Hall will be.
Again, this is a architectural rendering that they just developed, shared with us. We've not approved. We've got a lot of work to do to really look at the details and what really transforms out of this building.
Thank you.
This is a time of year. Every 2 years, we're required to do what we call a six-year capital plan or needs assessment for the university. This is just a very early snapshot of some of the first projects that we have identified. This is very similar to what was on our list last year. We go through with the university, with everyone, deans, and we'll review each project. We'll add new projects. These projects will get resorted. But at this snapshot, early, because this just opened up early January for us to start work on, I want everybody to note that our College Forward business is still our number one project. And in that request of $97,200,000, we have really several components. We have a new business college. We have a new parking structure. We have renovation of Grice Hall. And then we also have Tate Page Hall being taken down and South Lawn redone in that project funding. We've bundled all that. That was our strategy last year, and right now that's what we plan on doing this year. Probably start with the parking garage first, because we've displaced parking up on that end of the hill, and then we would work our way doing those projects.
Arnie, could you go back? On that last column, where it says federal or other.
That's usually private.
That's without all of those private?
Yes.
Okay.
That's typically what that means. And again, this is still early, and depending on how the food service contract works out, that may change.
That's the way the state requires us to submit a six-year capital plan, those four categories.
Okay. Do we have a restricted fund designated for Tate Page Hall, or is that something we would need to do?
The removal of Tate Page Hall is included in the $97,200,000 number for the Gordon Ford College.
I was looking.
But this project, is an upgrade. We continue to utilize that building at a pretty high capacity, and we are continually working on that structure to keep it for, because of the timing, we said 10, it's been 10, it's been 12, and we have to anticipate doing more work. We did quite a bit of work in it last year, and it really has some work inside needs to be done for the air conditioning system to continually be updated. But last year we did things like we replaced, 187 heating valves that were leaking, causing some issues. We re-insulated. We went through and cleaned all the ductwork. Had a company come in and clean the inside of it, treat it again. We did that about 10 years ago. Helps keep down contamination that could get in those ducts. But we've done that on several of our aging buildings over the last few years, trying to keep indoor air quality high.
Thank you. One more question.
Barbara, that has to be the last phase of the College of Business project, because you got to
get the one comes down, the other goes
new College of Business built. You got to get Grace Hall renovated before you can take Page Hall down. So it's probably 6 or 8 years at best. So over the course of time, we're going to have to continue to invest money in Tate Page Hall, because we're using it, a lot of people there, and you know that building well. It's
my other question.
It requires a lot of attention in order to keep it functional.
My other question probably is the Ouija board, but realistically, what do you see as the possibility for the Ouija board and business and renovation construction?
Well, that's our number one priority for state funding, and you're right, it is a Ouija board at best to try to predict when the Commonwealth will do capital projects. At the earliest, we wouldn't even have a chance to discuss it until the spring 2018 General Assembly, because that's the next time the budget will be in play. The state budget will be in play for the 18 to 20 biennium. There's just no way to tell at this point whether capital projects will get funded or not. We'll be in there pitching, but there's no way to tell at this point. And until, I mean, we're not going to... We might be able to raise some private money to help with that sum, but not what that project requires. So that's going to have to be primarily a state-funded project, and it will remain our top priority until we get it funded. Well, I can't give you a definitive answer.
But you gave me the answer.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Several years ago, we had an architect...
I just want to say, Dr. Renzel, and you, and for those of us who work in Tate Page, we truly appreciate what you're doing for the air quality in the building.
Hey,
better.
It's better.
I got a question, Brian. On the business college, is there a possibility that, or maybe this goes to you, Gary, is there a possibility that could be, I don't know what the correct term is, but re-engineered, redesigned, so that the price changes,
so that
the cost would be lower, such that we could probably have a better approach to the General Assembly. That may be pie in the sky type of deal, but
not in due. I'm afraid that we're maybe lowballing the cost of this building and the cost of Grace Hall renovation now. I don't know that we're going to be able to fit the renovation of Grace Hall in a projected $25 million budget. And each year that goes by, those costs go up. Now, the elimination of prevailing wage helps.
Yeah, sure, it absolutely.
But
does.
I want to be careful about backing off a number and then find that when it does get funded, we didn't have.
Right, and then it makes sense.
I think we need to be careful with that.
I agree.
We've already put over seven figures into site selection studies, schematics. You see a schematic. Mm-hmm. We've already spent a good bit of money, of our own money, preparing for that four-part project of the parking structure of the College of Business building, Rice Hall, and Tate Page. And you're looking at the images for the College of Business right there. But Jeff Katz is here, and he's been exceedingly patient. I think Jeff is here. You've been exceedingly patient, but we're going to stay with it, just like we did our science facilities until we got the science projects done, or almost done. But Yeah, my fear is that may be a lowball number as time marches on.
I do want to compliment.
And that answers. I wonder. I think it needs to be
Dr.
said.
Dr. Katz, that they and their department over at Grice Hall have continually invested in their own program, doing upgrades. We just finished, what was the last Friday? The auditorium that was there, put all new seating in, and it was really dilapidated, but Jeff's department paid for that. They've done some other upgrades. We've done some upgrades with them. We've got some other projects that we're going to take care of, replacing some air handling units to better condition the building. We continually to invest in our older buildings. We're very limited in funds, so we are right now, we've done one for indoor air quality with Jones-Jaggers. We're just completing replacing the entire air handling unit. I think last year we did the air handling units for Helm Library. And honestly, you know, behind the scenes we don't see it, but these devices are rusting down to the frames in those buildings. And so we are working on those strategically. And each summer and each year we keep working on those types of projects. But like I said, Jeff's done some really wonderful things in the business college. So.
We appreciate your support.
But it really is helpful to attract students and keep it fresh. I'll quickly finish with our projects. Student Life Foundation has several resident hall projects that are to follow the Hilltopper Hall. And they'll be the Barnes and Bemis campus. We're going to do some upgrades over at the directional buildings. Going to make that four-story. About $116 million, Brian? Yeah,
$120 total.
So there's some other projects that they'll be working on around campus over the next couple of years that'll be very beneficial.
Any other questions, Brian? I would like to comment and recognize that over the last few days I've had the occasion to communicate with our preferred candidate. He's been around campus and came back to Ransdale and President Ransdale and Julie for hosting that tour. He is in awe of facilities and the grounds of this campus. And, sometimes I think maybe we take a little bit for granted, but thank you, because you truly have transformed this campus environment into a first-class, invaluable. So, Brian, thanks to your team.
No, thank you all.
The transformation the President Ransdale has accomplished. Anyone else on capital projects? That will conclude the agenda items for the executive committee. We'll next turn to finance and budget. Chair Johnson.
Thank you, Freddie. We have four action items that were all approved at the December committee meeting, so they're on the consent agenda. They appear on pages 1, 3, 7, and 8 of the handout. Does anybody wish to remove one from the consent agenda? Not hearing that, I believe we consider them all together, and so I'll entertain a motion to approve action items number 1 through 4.
I'll move.
Regent Birch, motion, second?
Second.
Oh, Cynthia, seconds. Any further discussion or comments? Hearing none, I'll ask all those in favor to say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Carries unanimously. And we have two information items this morning, competitive bidding process and student financial assistance. So I will turn the program over to Ann Mead.
The first one I'll address, and the second one our Director of Student Financial Assistance will address, and as President Ransell said, these are two topics that the regents have expressed interest with. I asked, you know, Jim Cummings, our Chief Financial Officer, I asked him to move up front, make me feel more comfortable with a topic that I know less about, and he's the expert. So I'll do the presentation, and I'll probably have whiplash going, Jim. But hopefully I can answer your questions, but between the two of us. We'll keep this at kind of a high level. It can get a bit dry and tedious, but we'll try to give you just a slight overview of what we mean by competitive bidding process. My staff told me I was behind the times. I was used to, do you remember having a Department of Purchasing? Well, Department of Purchasing has evolved in so many ways, especially with technology, that I agreed to say, you know, maybe it's time to go with the times and update the name. So this last year they changed to Supply Chain Management with, as you see, a logo indicating that it's multifaceted with between purchasing, shipping and receiving, paying for what you buy, and recording the inventory. So that's when I refer to Supply Chain Management. Sometimes I'll slip up and still call them purchasing. And guess what? I have to tell you, I'm tech challenged. So there, we'll do the best we can. I've had people up here do the mouse for me, but today I'm going to step up. So the first thing I want to tell you, what are you trying to do when you get goods and services? Obviously, we're good stewards of our money. We want value. We want the appropriate authority. We want compliance. We comply with Kentucky Revised Statute, and embedded in complying with that, in fact, would be what we call the Model Procurement Code. So we're talking about a process of acquiring goods and services. So internally for us, there's different rules and regulations if it's less than 40,000 or greater than 40,000. And I'm not sure that that threshold has not been that way for decades. But this is how we divide our procurement process. So departments have a lot of authority for less than 40,000, with some restrictions, as you hear from internal audit, as how they can use their procurement card. And it's very efficient and allows acquisition of a lot of supplies and goods. So a majority of our purchasing probably happens through the less than 40,000, whether it's requisitions or quotes through supply chain management or contract options. Contract options include purchasing organizations, consortiums. We have the Kentucky Educational Purchasing Consortium. We look to see what other universities have contracted. Sometimes when there's contracts, you can look at state agencies or even the federal government that allows you to get the best price by, in fact, using a contract that already exists. Greater than 40,000, we'll have contracts, we'll have bids, and we'll have requests for proposals. And on a limited number of bases, you'll find what's called sole source, where you truly believe that's the only provider, and we can justify by not particularly going through the time and effort to bid something because it is, in fact, we're confident that we would not find anyone else to provide those services. So purchasing by competitive process. Let me remind you that, at least through the last committee meeting, one of the items that you approve annually is our House Bill 622 compliance report. And I may be the only one, maybe Jim remembers it. Why do we have a House Bill 622 compliance report every year? That was an outcome of passing House Bill 622, which I believe was in 1980. And what it did is it empowered universities to do everything from their own payroll to their own purchasing to eventually our own capital construction. But again, we have to be consistent. We agreed in that House Bill 622 compliance report to say just because we're empowered doesn't mean that we're setting our own rules. So we're complying still, as I indicated earlier, with everything that's statutorily based that applies to any other state agency. But that was a significant change for higher education in 1980. To digress just for a second, Jim may remember that we had to send our payroll up to Frankfurt. We weren't allowed to cut our own checks. So, and being able to do our procurement locally had a significant impact. But again, we have to commit to doing it based on state requirements. One of most interest to this group would probably be the bid process. There's typically bids that we have out on the street right now, everything from examples are furniture and vehicles, but we have bids on the street right now, quotes, as I sometimes maybe more appropriate in my next example, but we need to print the Spirit magazine. So when we look at how to get the best value and the best quality, we'll ask this community, especially we'll notify them and let them know that we're looking for someone that could provide us those services. In these bids, typically where we want to get the best value again for the item that we're purchasing. RFPs, in abbreviation, request for proposals. Requests for proposals are a little more complicated. It's easy to do a bid or a quote in saying, I know exactly what type of vehicle I want. I know what I'm looking for in a quality of a print item or recruitment material. But requests for proposals are a bit more complex. A little more room for subjectivity about how to meet our needs. Some of the examples are software systems, services. You might do a request for proposals for audit services, banking services. The big one right now that we have not finalized is dining services. All those fall under request for proposals. So how do we do a request for proposal? Requests for proposals start with a pre-RFP process. We select an evaluation committee, and depending on the topic, you want the expertise that are best informed to help contribute to the selection. So one recent selection process recently was the administration of our procurement card. We had representatives on that committee, obviously a lot of people from finance administration that would have to, in fact, interact with this vendor. We had selected large users cross campus. Who uses the procurement card the most, and what do they value in the service and the ease of using that card and balancing and reconciliations, what data do they get? So we have an evaluation committee. The other important step to work with supply chain management is, can you, from the primary people that will benefit from a service or a product, what is it do they really need to be able to do their job effectively? What qualifications should that vendor bring to the table? So we do research to determine also, have any other universities been doing the same thing, and what did they learn from their bid process? A request for a proposal document, while we could probably look at one page that says the heart of it, request for proposal process identifies legal language, standard terms and conditions that must be met by any vendor. The scope of the project, what type of evaluation criteria are important to identify that which is going to drive the selection process. We advertise that a bid is, quote-unquote, on the street. We use technology. It's called Top Shop. Most vendors know that we post these opportunities for them to bid online. But we also reach out to prospective vendors to make sure that they know this opportunity is available. Anybody that has a significant reputation in a certain field will research it, and we'll invite them, in fact, to register through Top Shop and participate through this process. So how long do you have? If it's a very complex request for proposals, you're going to give a vendor like Dining more time to prepare a response. But the state requires that we have a minimum of 7 days between the time that the last time you updated any information about that request for proposals. So let's say that you have some vendors say, your RFP is not clear on a few points, and they ask questions. We take those questions, we send them back out to any prospective bidder, we post the answers online, and from that last communique back to prospective vendors, then we allow them a minimum of 7 days to prepare a response. And obviously, some items are a lot more complex, and you wouldn't expect it to turn around that fast. There's no right way to do a wrong thing. Okay, I got that from my director of supply chain management, but it's true. We value the ethics, fairness, and confidentiality in this process. All of us on the evaluation committee know that it needs to stay confidential, and we want, I call it a level playing field. We want any prospective vendor to have the exact same information and an equal opportunity to compete in this bid process. Proposals are received by a certain deadline. In Top Shop, I can actually log in 1 second after it's due, and I can view who in fact has submitted a bid. The process will include meeting of the evaluation committee, and then if necessary, bidders will come in and make presentations. That's up to the evaluation committee to, whether they think the bids that have been submitted are clear enough and whether we ought to have presentations. The committee members independently score the proposals, and then they tabulate the results. Awarding the contract. Now, didn't that seem real easy? Sometimes after, depending of the complexity of an RFP, sometimes it's obvious who the preferred vendor is, but there may be a period of negotiating the final contract, but not in a manner that would place any advantage to that vendor, saying, well, if another prospective vendor had known that you'd be willing to accept certain modifications to a bid that was submitted, that it would disadvantage. So there's still some final negotiation that's reasonable to occur with a final vendor, and that's that typically happens before you finally award the contract. The so it'll vary from year to year how many bids, RFPs we have. Sometimes you'll have some large heavy hitters, dining, procurement card. Right now we have one on the street for administration of our residual student financial aid student employment card. So students don't get checks anymore. It goes to a card or it goes to their bank account. That's one that's on the street right now. Looking over fiscal year 12 to fiscal year 16, the low was 42, the high was 78. And as I indicated, some examples, requests for a quote, the Spirit Master publication, solid waste disposal and recycling, promotional materials, charter bus services, electronic student refund, laboratory equipment. So those are items that we have underway right now. Our policies and procedures are online and are very detailed for the campus to understand what are the steps to follow for purchase by competitive negotiation. And obviously, occasionally you'll have a sole source. I hope that was informative. And, Jim, can you think of something I should cover?
I can't, Ann. I think you did a great job. And if anyone has questions, I'll certainly try to answer them.
And I think you did a great job, too.
Well, thank you. I just had to fess up that I was a little out of my comfort zone on this one.
It was very helpful. Does it ever happen that you send out a request for bids on a contract, and I know you said you sometimes clarify, you do amendments to clarify.
Mm-hmm.
Does it ever happen that you send out a bid for a contract and determine as a result of feedback that maybe you need to redo the bid?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, I will see. I like to monitor Top Shop. I may be one of only two or three people that can. And there's times that it's canceled. You can come to a conclusion that perhaps you made your requirements too restrictive. And while the evaluation committee has that goal of meeting that requirement, they can come back and look at the bids and say, I think we might have to reject all of these. That's always an option. I think I missed that on one of the slides.
And I just want to take the opportunity to thank you and your team and Jim for the work that you do. Critical part of our university.
Thank you.
You guys excel.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Any other questions? Anybody want to do this? I'll tell you, they're a great group of individuals that run our supply chain management operation, everything from the procurement card to all these bid processes. I'm very proud, and thank you for the compliment. I'm very proud of the work they do.
Thank you, Ann. Our last information item will be student financial assistance.
Good morning.
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 I'm going to shift the gears and talk about our student population a little bit. So often we talk about who our students are academically, what they're achieving before they get here, what they achieve once they're here. We talk about where they're from. Are we getting in-state students, out-of-state students, international students? But a lot of times I think we focus a little less on who our students are financially. And that's kind of my goal today, to just do a semi-small educational process in that regard, because I think it's very important as we are evaluating the population that we serve here at WKU, as we start into our new strategic planning cycle, that we're aware of who our students are financially and their capacity in regards to affordability at WKU. This just kind of gives you an overview. 18,675 students received some type of financial assistance in 15-16, and this represented more than $200 million in aid assistance that these students received. You can see 48% of that was reflective in loans. Those are federal student and parent loans and private loans. And then we had 48% of the aid that was received was grants and scholarships and aid similar to that that did not have to be repaid. Again, with our grants and scholarships, we were federal, state, institutional, and third party. And then about 4% of that total represented student employment wages earned on campus. So as you can see, when you look at our total student population, we have 18,675 that are getting some type of resource and dependent on some type of resource to be able to meet those costs. This is kind of a financial snapshot of students who completed the FAFSA. Normally, we're not going to know adjusted gross incomes and financial information on just your average student. But for those that do complete the FAFSA, we're able to capture that information and kind of evaluate it. Of the students, undergrad students without a prior bachelor's degree, 30% of those had incomes below that considered poverty level. So when we're looking at the number of the students that completed the FAFSA, and the undergrad students without a prior bachelor's degree, 30% of our enrolled population had incomes below the poverty level. Based on the year that this was last year's data, that's below $24,250 for a household of four. And that is looking at both dependent students, looking in at parental income, and then also for independent students, looking at their income. Of the students, we're going to talk a little bit about grants on the next slide, but Federal Pell Grant is a need-based grant, and it is our highest need-based grant. 52% of the students that received this grant had estimated family contributions of zero. What that means is, based on the information that they submitted on the FAFSA, that's how we determine what type of aid they're going to be eligible for. And based on that information, the financials of the family, more than, 52%, so 3,366 students that received our Federal Pell Grant, their information indicated their family could contribute zero to their cost of attendance. So we have a large population there that are high need as well. Usually more than 30% of our undergraduate students receive some type of need-based grants. It's usually upper 30% in all honesty. This just kind of gives you a snapshot of our need-based grants. Pell Grants, as I mentioned, are federal. The amount that they can get per year ranges from $591 to $5,815. Those are prorated two ways. One, based on their estimated family contribution. For example, a family that could contribute zero to the student's cost of attendance would get $5,815 for the academic year if they were enrolled full-time. And it goes down. It's also prorated depending on enrollment status. So if they're full-time, they get the full amount. If they're not full-time, they get less. If you want to look at the tall green, and look at that decline, you'll see the numbers where we're looking at our most recent year in the 6,000, and we had the upper 7,000 in 12-13. Don't be alarmed that that's necessarily a decrease in the number of Pell-eligible students that we have or a decrease in enrollment. That's just kind of some of the changes in the program itself. For about 2 years, the Department of Ed implemented what's called year-round Pell. Students that are receiving Pell Grant, which again is our highest need-based grant, have an academic year limit. Current year, that's that 5815. So they can get a little over, you know, 2400 a semester. And for a couple of years, they toyed with the idea of allowing students that were high need to get Pell Grant year-round. So that allowed us to award those grants in winter term and summer term in hopes that those students could kind of graduate sooner, especially the high-need students. As financial aid professionals, we all knew what our volume was. We could not imagine that they could sustain that, and they figured out really quickly they couldn't. So we had about 2 years of tremendous growth in our Pell Grant funds that we spent because of that. But, again, it lasted about 2 years. So about the time that they implemented year-round Pell to, sorry, we can't afford it, now we're going to put limits on people. So we used to have students that were Pell Grant eligible that it's an entitlement, so they could continue to receive those funds as long as they were enrolled. So about July 1, 2012 is when they implemented, for the next academic year, they implemented lifetime limits. So that's where you'll see that gradual decline because students... A lot of students were running out of eligibility because they had received it for the maximum number of semesters that they could. Yeah.
What is the lifetime limit now?
It is 12 semesters. Based on full time.
Mm-hmm. Equivalent. Yes. So can they part time it out?
Correct. Yes, it's prorated. And once they reach that amount, then what we did the first year, because this is one of the regulations that, if anything we learn in financial aid, we have new programs, we have changes ongoing, and that one kind of came midstream. And so students that were already on that pathway, planning out their degree path, were not ready for that. So as a university, we did try to use some of our discretionary funds to help those students that were at the end of their career that did not know that they were going to have this, you know, this wall. We use discretionary funds to help those. But that's something that now is an ongoing need with that population. You'll look at CAP grant a little differently. That state grant, again, it goes to the same population. And those range from anywhere, typically 948 to 1900 per academic year. Again, it's prorated based on enrollment. But you'll see an increase in that. And unlike Pell is an entitlement. If you fill out the FAFSA and you're eligible, you're going to get it. With the CAP grant, state funds are limited, so first come, first serve. So we have really tried to do aggressive efforts. Historically, we have been the leader in four-year publics in the state of Kentucky that have utilized the CAP grant. Even schools that have larger enrollments than us, we typically are be awarding more CAP grant than they do, and that's kind of, I think, reflective of our student population and who they are financially. But we've also really tried to be aggressive in making sure that our students apply as early as they can. We really want them to get that FAFSA in as soon after it's available, because, again, funds are in several years ago, CAP grant funds might make it till July. Then they shifted it to about May. Then we got to where we're exhausting funds as early as March and February. And so in a traditional year when the FAFSA was available January 1, they were already running out of funds in that February time frame. So it was very important for our students to not wait. And so we were doing what we could to at least help them get that. SEOG is much smaller. You're going to see that's typically stayed pretty constant. That's campus-based. We decide who that's awarded to. It's federally funded. We have a X number of dollars. It's a small amount, but we use it to kind of help supplement books, at least we think with that population. This kind of shows you the trend a little better. As you can see, the federal Pell Grant, where we were in 12-13 to where we are in 15-16. The shift of our population has not changed. We still have a significant amount of students that are need-based eligible, but they're a little more limited with the resources that they can get. And that's, you can see the $23-24 million there that we spent in federal Pell Grant last year. The state grant is usually a little over $5 million, and you can see the steady increase in that.
Question, please.
Yes.
you know, the trend of cost of higher education is up, not down.
Correct.
And the Pell Grant is decreasing, and in that illustration, let's just use round numbers, that's $6 million compared to a $2 million up in the Kentucky cap. So where are we getting the $4 million differential to be able to fill the need for these students? Is that
We're
coming
not.
From private?
That's the problem.
We're not.
Yeah. That's
and so
a problem.
The student goes out and borrows money, probably.
Correct. And I'm going to illustrate that to you as well, and you're going to see where federal programs have also not kept pace in regards to loans with the rising costs. That shortfall we're seeing as we're counseling students and working with students and parents is just that gap is getting larger, and there's not necessarily additional resources available at the federal or state level to help offset that. Yes.
On the question, but that is a huge drop from 29 to 23 million. And you said that the student need hasn't changed.
Well, what's happened is the restrictions on the federal Pell Grant program has impacted the amount that we're awarding. We still have a very needy population, but we don't have what we've been evaluating for some time is those students that were in the pipeline that are now reaching maximum Pell limit. They're having limits on the amount that they can get. The other thing that dropped that somewhat is where we used to have year-round Pell, at least for a couple of years, we saw a spike, and then we've gone back down.
Are there other restrictions that, are those restrictions ones applied federally,
mm-hmm.
or are they as a result of any kind of campus
structure? No, it's all federal.
And we still have, I believe, the largest number, or I'm not sure about the dollar amount, of public four-year institutions in Kentucky. You said the CAP grant, but that also holds true for Pell Grant, does it not, or very close?
Probably very close. I know, I haven't seen, usually KIA will put out stats collective every couple of years, so I haven't seen where we are in the last, at least in the 15-16 award year in regards to the other four-year publics. But prior to that, we were usually well above that. Even schools that had greater enrollments, we were outpacing them with the amount of need-based aid that we were awarding.
I don't want to get ahead of you, but this graph really fascinates me, and the last graph, because I know for the past decade, the state has neglected to fund need-based financial aid, both CAP and KCG, at 100%.
Right.
And this shows that even though it has been defunded over time, with a little bit of a change last year, that we are getting more students who have CAP grant.
You could look at it two ways. Possibly we're getting more, but it's also that we're getting more students in the pipeline to, they have X number of dollars. It goes to UK, EKU, U of L, it goes to the privates, and it's everybody's at the race line trying to get their students in to get as much as they can. There is a percentage of students, and I don't have the number, but I certainly could get it. We have a significant number of students that are CAP grant eligible that go unfunded. You know, they apply after the funds are exhausted. So while I think that's reflective of yes, we're getting more, it's just we're trying to be more aggressive as well in those students and saying, especially as students that are need-based, that $1,900 is a big deal. You know, so they need to do what they can to try to get that taken care of so that they can be guaranteed. But don't let that misrepresent the fact that we still do have a significant number of students that are CAP grant eligible that go unfunded because funds are exhausted prior to that time.
One more question.
Okay.
You're doing a fantastic job, and I really commend you on this early application, especially it's like not bending over and picking up $20 on the ground. That's really what that is. However, what could we do as a university to increase that, to get it all, so to speak, of what the state? Is it all stressing that early? Do we need to get to the guidance counselors at the high schools and let that be known? Because if that's available, I mean, that literally is money on the ground you can just pick up.
Right. The biggest, we can't control human behavior. So as much as we have our students and our parents that understand the significance of this and they work really hard to get their FAFSA in and get the information so that they can be in for that. There's still that population of students that are eligible for this that, you know, we're telling them when they come in our office. We're sending notifications, apply early, apply early. Some just don't. So it's kind of, while we can put the word out there, they have to take the step as well because they have to submit the financial information. Sometimes there's scenarios where they can. It could be extenuating circumstances or they haven't done their tax returns or those kind of things yet. But I'll try to not bore you with the whole federal prior. But I think from a federal level, we're making a transition this year going into 17-18. Historically, FAFSA information has always been based on the prior year income tax information. And so that's a little challenging when you're telling someone apply soon after January 1 as you can, and they're not even filing their tax return until April. And so because of that, we know we've always had a population that wouldn't necessarily get their information in because they wouldn't be comfortable doing it on estimated or have the ability to do that. And so this year, prior, this is going into 17-18, they're calling it prior. Students applying for 17-18 are not using this year's income information but using last year's. So this year we have some little things we're dealing with 2 years, but going forward, that should certainly help. I would expect that will make even more of us at the race line because, they can use we're not waiting for tax returns to be done and those kind of things before the parents file. So we hope that will help.
It's a way we could use the Gordon Ford College of Business to assist those individuals who are having difficulty getting that money, getting those returns done or the review or an audit of some way to do a practical application of that. I mean, that seems
really
to be if
we have a tax service.
We do. Well, I know we do. Yeah.
And we assist faculty, students, to file their income tax.
So there we have a resource that we
partner.
Can marry so
mm-hmm.
that the student can get the money. I mean, if that is a stumbling block.
Right.
And to tie into your question, John, is how early can you go after those students, since enrollment and retention are important? How early can you go after them?
Up until this year, the FAFSA was not available until January 1 for the next year.
For the next year.
This year is October 1. So we went after them pretty quickly. But with the shift, this will kind of be a learning curve year for, I think, all institutions to see how well they responded to that. But going forward, we could go October 1, for example, 2016 for students entering 17-18.
And can you make the program, just to kind of follow up again on what John said, can you make what's available information to potential students well in advance of your January date or something like that? Does that help? Or?
Oh, yes. And we do. We send out notifications. And this doesn't just impact our incoming students. This is obviously our retention of our current students as well. And we send out reminders throughout the year reminding them to do it and to take care of it because it's very important. And we're the ones that are going to be counseling those students. As my staff said, how many tissue have they handed out this week? You know, we're the ones that are going to be counseling those students on whether it's financially feasible for them to stay or not. And so we do try to awareness. We use social media. We use a lot of different avenues to make sure that they're aware of the importance and the significance. But certainly, we could pursue that.
One of the challenges that we deal with, and it's reflected in some extent in the significant Pell Grant numbers and the CAP grant for that matter, but remember between 30 and 40% of our student population at any given snapshot in time are first-generation students. They don't come from families that understand the language.
Right.
Things like credit hours, what's that mean? Simple language, FAFSA, it's a foreign language to them. And it's in large measure it is to their parents. And these are students that come from the heart of our primary service area and small towns, small counties across Kentucky, and it's just a challenge. And in many cases, they're not getting that reinforcement at home
right. On
what to do, when to do it. You got to be on this, and so that's a real challenge for us, given the nature of our student population, who are eligible for this level of Pell Grant funding. And it's just something we deal with as best we can. And a lot of these students aren't even deciding whether they're going to go to college or not until almost too late to be eligible for these kinds of awards. So it's a constant challenge, and we communicate as early and promptly and expeditiously as we can. And it's a constant educational process.
It is. And I think having done this for a while, we're seeing the trends even more so. It's not the days of where students would save money or parents would save money. Usually they're not coming in with resources available to help towards any shortfall. And then we've got to do what we can to identify resources. And even starting with our 17-18 year, we've put together a pretty aggressive, from our standpoint and partnering with the bursar's office, financial literacy, just some things that we're trying to do. From the minute that they apply for admission and are accepted for admission, we're sending them information. When they actually come for an orientation, we're saturating them with information. And we have a multi-stage process where we don't want the first time they even think about their financials is when they get their bill. So we're trying to make them aware of the financial implications prior to that so that then there's a little more time to get a summer job, you know, or do the things that they need to help meet that cost.
Cindy.
Yes.
Piggybacking on Professor Ensel's comments about FAFSA, I think if you've never had the opportunity to help anybody fill out a FAFSA form, you missed a real learning experience and a great experience.
Like tax returns.
And
it's simpler now than it's ever been.
I think the reality of it is that, especially for first-generation kids, but not exclusive to that, some of the smartest people I know can't figure out how to fill out a FAFSA form. Is there anything, I don't think it's sometimes a matter of lack of communication, but we all tend to avoid those things we don't understand or we're intimidated. Is there anything we can do that enhances the ability of people to fill out that? Do we do anything that, I mean, do we get involved with helping people do that?
Yes, there's different things. High school counselors, I think, are depended on a lot for that because a lot of the high school counselors are counseling those students, the senior counselors especially, with the college choice. And we actually do, as our state association, we do several things across the state, different events throughout the year where we are going into the schools and helping their student population with the FAFSAs. We provide College Goal Sunday every year where we invite it's usually at 20-plus sites across the state on one particular day. We host a site here, and we invite all the students in this area that are about to enter, and, of course, a current student could come too. And we have we go through the FAFSA in a presentation to try to keep it as interesting as we can but get the gist of it. We encourage them to bring their tax information with them, and we have counselors available. We do it here in mass media. We use the rooms, and we sit down with them and help them submit it. The challenge is a lot of times the students that need to be there are not the ones that come, you know, and that's where we almost have to rely on the high school guidance counselors to know who those students are and help them or reach out to us as well. So now that we've talked about our highest need population, let's talk a little bit about other resources that are available, and this is federal loans. These are, these are just federal loans. I've excluded private loans from this, but subsidized loan recipients, if you look at that number, you'll see we have almost 7,000 students that receive subsidized loan. Subsidized loans are need-based, which means they are non-interest-bearing until the student graduates or ceases enrollment. And you can see that volume there for last year was near $26 million. That's the amount of resources that we awarded to students in need-based loans. The unsubsidized loan are non-need-based. You can see the number there that we awarded to, and you can see the amount that we awarded there. Unsubsidized, you could have a student, and this is a large percentage of our population as well. We might have, you see the number that we have that are need-based eligible, Pell eligible, federal grant eligible. We have as many that sometimes are referred to as that murky middle for various reasons, but we have a large percentage of students that maybe aren't Pell eligible, but based on the cost, based on their estimated family contribution from the information that was submitted on the FAFSA, they still have significant need. So we will award subsidized loans to those, and then we'll come in with the unsubsidized loan. Those are student loans. Those loans are in the student's name. The student is the borrower. They're not credit based, as long as you know they're not in default on a prior student loan, and most are not when entering. That's not an issue. Those loans are available to them. The challenge with the subsidized and unsubsidized loans is probably the last time they were changed, the annual limit was 2008, and it was only slightly, and it was 15 years before that there had been any adjustment. So as someone pointed out earlier, the costs are rising, but the federal resources available are still limited. To put it in perspective, an incoming freshman can get $5,500 a year in a student loan. That's $2,750 a semester. Tuition is $99.12 a year, $49.56 a semester. So if you have a student that's not grant eligible and they're looking for what type of assistance can we provide, federal loans is it, we can help them pay for about half of their tuition. And so they've still got to figure out how to pay the other half of tuition, and that's just using an undergrad in-state student. They've still got to figure out how to pay the other part of tuition, housing, meals, and books, much less incidental cost. So that becomes the challenge. While costs continue to rise, federal aid programs are not necessarily keeping pace with that. And you'll see the plus number here. That's parent loans. So those are loans that are in the students' names. Those do require a credit check. See, we did about $18 million in parent loans there. We do have a significant number of students that apply for the parent loan because that's the next resource we can offer them that are denied and they don't have eligibility. You'll see that UNSEB number so high, the PLUS denials drive that up because there is an additional UNSEB loan that we can award to parents, to students who have a parent loan that's been denied. I know these aren't fun facts to hear.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, there's an annual limit and there is an aggregate limit, and $31,000 is the undergrad aggregate limit. So if you have the annual limit for a freshman is $5,500, sophomore $6,500, junior and senior would be the $7,500.
Okay. So that students
and grad can get, they have a different aggregate limit, and we have a grad plus, so there's different dynamics there depending on their eligibility. But for an undergrad, while they have annual limits, $31,000 is the max that they can receive in their Stafford loans. This, you can see how the average loan debt for WKU undergrad graduating students has risen. We actually just pulled our 15-16 data last week, and we're at that $28,000. You can see where the shift has gone up. Keep in mind that they're borrowing more, but the annual limits are not rising, and the aggregate is not rising.
So just a clarification. On your original pie chart, you had 48% of the cost of the education was in loans, and that was about $98 million, and you just showed us that's about $94 million of the sources from...
It was 48% of the $200 million that we've awarded.
Right.
Yeah.
So you've just identified about $95 million of where those loans are coming from.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Could you go back? Looking at 06 to 16, do you think most of that represents tuition changes? Or, I mean, would that be...
I mean, that would certainly drive that up. So, on the back side, something else that we have to look at, not only trying to help students identify resources on the front end, and again, keep in mind, we have a pretty significant need-based population. We have students that are not necessarily need-based, your average family, probably with the average income, that really just have student loans as a resource available to them. But then those students that get the loans, what happens on the backside? We're also responsible for helping them secure the benefits, but then if those students default on these federal loans, then it can come back and have implications to us as well, even though those are things that we can't control. Parent loans do not factor into this, thankfully, because then we would really have a bigger issue than we do. But if you look at our, and don't think this is dated info, fiscal year 2013, these are three-year cohorts. And the fiscal year 13 data is what was just released in September. So that is the most current that we have. Our cohort default rate is 11.3, our most recent one. National average is about 11.3. So we're hanging in there with the national average. You can see Kentucky average is 15.5. What drives that up is the community colleges. Their cohort default rates are typically much higher than your four-year publics. 11.3, it's hard for those that have done it a little while because we've seen the years of where our cohort default rates were 5% and 6%. and 7%. So we've definitely seen the shift. They used to do a two-year evaluation, and the numbers were a little lower based just on the formula itself. But for 3 years, that means three classes that have entered in that they're evaluating, and 11.3% of those that borrowed during that period are going into default. And so,
are we held to a, I mean, is there any kind of current guideline on expectation?
Mm-hmm, absolutely, yes. If we reach 25%, all of our federal aid programs could be in jeopardy, which would be our federal grants, our student loans, and all of that. Normally what happens, and I think there's some two-year programs that are in that phase right now in the state of Kentucky, where if they hit that threshold, it's not an immediate removal of aid programs, but they have to like have a default management plan and have put different things in place to try to bring that number down. So those are all things where on the front end we're doing all we can to help get the students resources. We also have to do all we can to educate them and make sure they understand the importance of repaying that, because we don't want it to affect future aid programs with students. We actually outsourced to Kia. We've done that. This is our second year now, and we are partnering with them on our outreach efforts to try to bring that number down.
That's the Kentucky Higher Education Assistance Authority. Cindy, go back one slide.
Okay.
I want to Barbara's point. You're exactly right, but the correlation to that is declining in state funding. You follow this chart, particularly since 2008, and you look at how much our budget's been cut from the state and how much we've had to try to offset some of that with tuition. That's why we're now at $200 million in our $400 million budget from tuition revenue, and our state funding has either been flat or in decline. And we've lost $17 million in state funding since 2008. So tuition goes up, students have to borrow more, direct correlation, and that's why this presentation is so important for this board to understand how all these dynamics are interrelated. And when we express our concerns about state budget cuts, the students who end up getting hit the hardest when that occurs. And we're at a point now where our tuition elasticity is thin at best. And so, you know, 3%-ish the last few years, that's what our tuition increase margin has been and will likely be again next year. And that's not generating enough revenue, particularly when we're putting more and more into both need and merit-based scholarship support. That's where a lot of that tuition increase is going, is right back into financial aid for students in the form of need and merit-based scholarships. So the dynamics are interwoven, and that's one of the things I'm hoping this board can understand from just understanding the financial, the need-based financial aid profile.
And I think, when we look at the students that apply for aid and are using some type of resource, like I said, that the need-based are at least getting the federal and usually the state, but sometimes there's still a shortfall there for those students as well. The students that are non-grant eligible and are totally relying on loans, that shortfall is pretty significant. Our university scholarship model, you may recall, I think we provided that information to the board a year or two ago. That was one of the things that drove our restructure of that, because when we were doing our university merit awards and trying to target our high academic students and our high performing, we were a little top heavy. And so what we wanted to do was try to take the same pocket of money and distribute it to more. And we did that. You know, I was looking at first time freshman year awards are usually in about that 1200 range, and for our university merit, but our returning student awards for sophomore, junior, and senior are anywhere from 14 to 1500. So we have impacted, you know, the entering class, and that was kind of year one. We have different phases of that we would like to do, and one of those is really looking at zeroing in on our students that have financial barriers, even students that maybe don't necessarily qualify for need-based, but all their eligibility is loans, you know, and what can we do to try to close the gap better for them. And so that's something, even with our university merit funds that we've looked at phase one, we hope with phase two that we'll be able to secure resources to look at our current students and try to help provide them resources as well. But that's it.
Well, Well done, Cindy. Well done. It's a complex profile, and we're still awarding about $28 million, give or take, in academic merit-based scholarships out of our university budget for merit-based scholarships. So that's not included in the $200 million number that you saw from other sources for need-based aid.
Yeah. So it's a challenge. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate that presentation. I think it's very informing as well, so I want to echo those comments. Anybody else have any questions of the Finance Committee? Hearing none, well, I'll turn it back over.
Thank you. I want to introduce our board. Probably no introduction is necessary, but our new parliamentarian today.
Just for today.
Chase. I don't know.
Chase, appreciate you filling in and glad to have you.
Can we give him a problem or something?
We'll
yeah, let's jump on him.
We've been before us before, but give us a brief intro of what you do and
On a daily basis, I'm the Director of Recruitment and Admissions here at WKU, so undergraduate domestic recruitment and admission of students. So that entails the going out into high schools and meeting with students and parents, and then our office is also responsible for new student orientation when they come and kind of helping them make that transition from high school to college. So Dr. Capps was unable to be here today, and so I got a call Saturday from Julia McDonald asking if I would be able to step in, and I tried to come up with a number of reasons why I shouldn't, but none of them were good enough.
She didn't accept any of them.
I don't think I really gave him an option.
No, it was.
Thank you very much.
Jace is neglecting to include his work he did with
the
forensics.
That's yes. Yes.
Maintaining the quality and
yes.
Championship style of our forensics program. So lucky you got off with that. he is the John Wooden of forensics.
Everybody's always so much more excited about that than admissions.
I don't know why. Well, we're excited about admissions, I promise you. Let's take a short break. That suits everyone, and we'll reconvene here in about 10 minutes or so.
Okay.
Appreciate you.